Now, I know I'm probably dreaming, but I'd like to reserve just a little bit of time at the end of class to go over what we've talked about and what we've learned. I see Rob already shaking his head. He knows. All right, Esther chapter 8. Let's start by reading verses 1 through 7. And that brother got the... We have a mic, somebody? Oh, there we go.
On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told him how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet, and implored him with tears to counteract the evil plot of Haman the Agag and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agag, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred?" Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, "Indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman and have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews."
All right, go ahead and do verse 8 as well.
"You yourselves write a decree for the Jews as you please in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a letter which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke."
All right, so remember, we've got a problem from last week. Haman has been hanged, but we still have this edict that was sealed with the king's signet ring that Haman came up with. And as noted here in verse 8, if it's been signed into law, it can't be revoked. And we talked about a little bit earlier in our study why that was. So there were two primary reasons that we looked at. The first was, you didn't want your king just arbitrarily making laws. So by putting that restriction on him, that you can't revoke laws once they've been put into effect, you force them to consider the laws that they're putting into effect. Now, does that always work? No, it doesn't, because we have here King Xerxes who signs law into effect on behalf of Haman. You may recall over in Daniel when Darius had some regrets about the law that he put into effect that ended with Daniel in the lion's den. So because of these edicts that are essentially eternal, we have an issue here. And the second one was that the kings were supposedly led by their gods. And you can't exactly say, well, my gods led me astray and I made this law and I shouldn't have. That's not really in your best interests when you're the emperor of an empire as large as the Persians. And we'll take a look at that in just a little bit, exactly how large it was. Okay, so we have Mordecai that's promoted. And what's the first thing that happens here to Mordecai? We have the distribution of Haman's estate. What's the first thing that happens to it? What's that? Okay, it goes to Esther. It first actually goes to the king, right? So property of the condemned criminals actually reverts to the crown. If you'll remember Jezebel's plot over in 1 Kings chapter 21, what does she have Ahab do? She has him murder the guy after he's been condemned for blasphemy. And as a result, his property becomes part of the king's estate. And that's how they go and steal the plot of land from somebody whose name now escapes me. I'm blanking out on it, but that's okay. You know the one I'm talking about. The vineyard. All right, so why would it make sense for Xerxes to promote Mordecai? Well, it looks like it's already up there. So you can... So we do have the fact that Mordecai saved the king's life and had been honored for it, and he's familiar with the bureaucracy, right? He worked at the king's gate. He's already part of the officials here. Mordecai has been Esther's advisor, and Xerxes is in need of someone to replace Haman. He's just killed his number two, so he needs a new number two. I don't know what that says about the position of number two in Xerxes' kingdom. Maybe it's a little volatile. I don't know if you want that, but it's open. And he raised Esther. So Mordecai replaces Haman, but his elevation is connected to Esther. And we're told that it's because Esther told how he was related to her. And the Hebrew phrase there is literally what he was to her. Note that Xerxes takes the signet ring and gives it to Mordecai. Where did that signet ring come from? Yep, came from Haman. So, again, maybe a little macabre in our modern-day sensibilities, but he takes the signet ring from Haman, who he's just hanged, gives it to Mordecai. Here you go, you're the new number two. All right, so next up we have this slide about reversing the edict. About 70 days elapsed between the day when Haman's decree was first recorded and the day when Haman's decree was reversed. The third month, Sivan, falls around May/June in the Gregorian calendar, or the Julian calendar for Persian period dates. So the Jews have about 9 months of preparation before the two edicts are due to be implemented. Incidentally, Haman's plan was concocted in the first month of Xerxes' 12th year, so the equivalent of March or April in 474 BC. Mordecai's decree was approved in the third month, so May or June of 474 BC. The date they both referred to was the 12th month, which would be February or March of 473 BC, the following year, at least in terms of how we calculate it. All right, so Esther goes into the king one more time, and this time it's to plead for the salvation of her people. How does she enter that plea? Okay, fell down before him. It says she goes in with weeping, and she is essentially begging the king to reverse the edict, revoke the documents that Haman devised. And note again, she only implicates Haman in this. She leaves Xerxes completely out of it. So this is a cool slide. This is an inscription of Xerxes in the old Persian. Highlighted here, you can see that's Xerxes' name right there. I thought that was really cool. Anyway, so this is a tablet showing the examples of the name Ahasuerus or Xerxes written in Old Persian cuneiform. This artifact is photographed at the National Museum of Iran. And once again, how does Xerxes deal with the problem? Yeah, he delegates, right? Like any good leader, right? I've surrounded myself with good people. You guys have, you know, a brain between you. Figure it out. It's kind of what you get the impression that he does here. That's very much in keeping with Xerxes' behavior that we've seen before in the past, though. He told Haman, do as you like. He told he went to his advisors for advice on what to do with Vashti. And now, once again, we have Xerxes delegating the problem. You have the signet ring, which means that they have what? They have authority. Yeah. He's essentially given them carte blanche to do whatever they please to fix the problem, short of revoking the actual edict. So he says, you've got everything you need to solve this. Go forth and do it. This is about what we've come to expect from Xerxes. I don't know if that means he's a good manager of people or if he's just... I don't know what that says about his character. But I do know that people who are good managers surround themselves with competent people who are capable of doing good jobs. So maybe that's... maybe we can put that in his favor. That he has people that he trusts to help him run his kingdom, and, well, it failed him before with Haman, but at least he's got Mordecai on his side this time, right? All right, let's go ahead and read Esther chapter 8, verses 9 through 14. Brother Rogers here.
So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, which is the month of Sivan, in the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, to the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces in all, to every province in its own script, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from the swift steeds. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and to protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. And on one day, in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province and published for all people, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out, hastened, and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan, the citadel.
All right. So, first question is, what's the fix that they come up with? How are they going to solve the problem of the king's edict that the Jews are to be destroyed by their enemies? Go ahead, Steve. Okay. So the Jews are given the authority on a previous date, you'll know the previous month, to go out and assault their enemies. So they get to attack first. And then there's nobody left that wants to attack them after that. Well, that is effective at solving the problem, as we're going to see. Now, I think this slide is really neat because these tablets have a couple of interesting things about them. One is there's this collection of tablets related to Jewish communities in the area of Babylon about the time of Esther. These documents are written in Akkadian and point to the adoption of that language and script by at least some of the Jewish population at the time and the region. It also illustrates the fact that a rather large number of copies of the new edict would have to have been prepared. Again, I'm amazed by the fact that I wonder how long it took to actually carve out one of these tablets. It's not like they wrote these things on a piece of paper like you and I would, you know, just write something down. I can make a few copies of something pretty fast. I guess you got really fast with a chisel? I don't know. But this is how they distributed copies of the edict. I also feel bad for the mailman who had to carry those edicts. That seems like it'd be heavy. If copies were to be sent to each province and each people, it would have required the edict to be in multiple languages. It mentions 127 different provinces from essentially from Africa all the way to India and across Europe as well. Dozens, if not hundreds, of individual copies must have been made. So this collection, known as the Al Yahudu tablets, was photographed in the Bible Lands Museum in Jerusalem. So we have a second edict. It's written, it's distributed, it mirrors Haman's earlier edict. The Jews now get to make use of the Persian administration and postal network to their advantage. Previously, it's been to their detriment. Now we've reversed that entirely, and they're able to take advantage of that. So here's a copy of the writing, issued as law in every province and published to all the peoples. The Behistun inscription is an example of royal proclamation or decree. This Aramaic copy is on display in the Neues Museum in Berlin. All right. There we go. The time required to get any message to the farthest reaches of the empire is easy to underestimate. For example, one of the Jewish communities of the Persian Empire that was most distant from Susa was the one situated on the island of Elephantine in southern Egypt. So, all the way down here. That was 1,700 miles from Susa. If a courier on horseback is allowed 40 miles a day, that's a bit of a generous estimate, that trip would have taken 45 days to accomplish. So it's a month and a half before a courier can get from the capital to the farthest reaches of the empire. Now, it's worth noting, the Persians constructed a road that ran from Susa to Sardis in Asia Minor. That's this thing right here. That was about the same distance, 1,600 miles, 1,677. Ancient authors indicate that this road could be traveled by a mounted courier in as little as 2 weeks. But that's a unique situation. That's a road built for specifically that purpose. It's doubtful that those kinds of roads existed elsewhere. Historians deemed this one remarkable. So it probably took at least a month to get that decree out to everybody. Mordecai's edict is written on the 23rd day of the third month. So how long has elapsed since we started all of this? About 3 months, exactly. So 3 months have taken place since chapter 3, where we have the events that led to the original edict from Haman. The very best royal bred horses were used to ensure the express delivery of this new edict. So the descriptions associated with the second edict supersede those relating to the first. The first one went out on fast couriers. These are the absolute best of the best. We're going to give the Jews every advantage they could possibly have to have time to prepare for this attack that's coming. This is remnants of that street in Sardis leading to Persia. The Romans built on top of it later, and that was originally part of the royal road constructed by Persian kings to facilitate communication across the empire. So this road ran between Susa and Sardis. Herodotus reports that the full distance of the road took 90 days to walk, but a message delivered by relay team could do it in about 2 weeks. All right. So the Jews have been empowered to assemble and protect themselves. Those are military terms and used for positioning an army to defend against an attack. We also see mirroring in the language that's used. What are the Jews allowed to do? It says to kill, to destroy, to annihilate their enemies. Exactly the same language that was used for Haman to destroy the Jews. There's also a parallel here with the destruction of the Amalekites, isn't there? What are the Jews allowed to do? Or what are they given the authority to do? Okay, whatever they wanted. It's a little bit more bounded than that, isn't it? But who are they specifically given the authority to go after? Women and children. Okay, so they're given the authority to destroy the women and children. And what else? Okay, they're given the authority to plunder their enemies. As we discussed earlier, in this kind of situation, normally that plunder would have reverted to the state, to Persia. But in this case, the Jews are given the authority to plunder their enemies and take their goods for themselves. Now, a little bit different from the Amalekites, right? What were they to have done in the case of the Amalekites?
Get rid of everything, including livestock.
Okay, get rid of everything. They weren't to even plunder their enemies. It was supposed to be all dedicated to destruction. So, similar but not quite the same. So Mordecai's edict reverses Haman's edict by giving power to those from whom all power had been taken. I think there's a bit of a lesson here in how God operates. Does God help those who help themselves? Is that how he's described in the Bible? I see some heads shaking. What's the verse that we go back to that describes how God helps us? Okay, this says, while we were what? Sinners or helpless. God is the help of the helpless. It says he is the defender of the fatherless and the widow. Our God is the one who is capable of lifting up the fallen. That's the character of our God. Not somebody who helps people who are already doing well, although he does do that. But our God is one who gives power to the powerless, who helps the weak, who lifts up the fallen. And that's the picture of the God that we get here in the book of Esther. He's going to go to a people that cannot defend themselves. They're in captivity. They are completely in the hands of the Persians. They have no authority to help themselves. And yet, through Esther and Mordecai, they're given that authority. They're given the help that they need. And God helps them when they could not help themselves, just like he helps us when we were sinners. When we could not help ourselves, he sent his son. All right, let's read Esther chapter 8, verses 15 through 17. I've got Cassidy over here.
Thanks.
When Mordecai left the king's presence, he was wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen. And the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them.
All right, so how did Mordecai's situation change? Let's take a simple one. What's the change in his clothing now? Where did we go from and where did we go to? Okay, we're going from sackcloth and ashes to royal garments. And that's really symbolic of the Jews as a nation, or as a people, as a whole, in Persia here. That they've gone from this position of dishonor to a position of honor. What else? What symbolically speaking, again, how has Mordecai's disposition changed? And the disposition of the people? Okay, they've gone from mourning to rejoicing. So we have those that we have to consider, but now what new dangers does Mordecai face in his position? Well, he's the new number two, right? And as we mentioned before, number two under Xerxes was not a safe place to be. We also have examples from men like Daniel, who were highly appointed in the kingdom of first the Babylonians and then the Medes and the Persians. He was not well liked by his peers, and as a result, we had the incident with the lion's den. All right, now we have for the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And many of the people of the land became Jews. Now, the subject is people of the land, i.e. non-Jews, and became Jews might equally be translated professed to be Jews. So that translation is helpful because it can carry the various ideas associated with the term. What's at stake here? Okay, their lives. It sure looks good to be on the side of God when God is conquering. Where did we see that last week? We read about it, right? Rahab's statement to the spies was what? They heard about it, and what happened as a result? Okay, they were terrified. It said their hearts melted within them. They were terrified of this God that had dried the Red Sea up. It said that we've heard about the deeds of your God. So it wasn't just Rahab that had heard about them. It was everybody. She was just one of the people. She's the only one that had the right reaction to that news. But everybody had heard about it. Everybody knew what was coming. And it's important, this parallel that the phrase creates with Esther's own journey. Esther chooses to identify herself with her people, in spite of the risks involved. Now, non-Jews choose to identify themselves with the Jews because they see only the benefits from doing so. The second issue is this nature of the fear that's gripped the non-Jews. It could conceivably mean that there's this growing influence and power in the form of Mordecai. It's good to get on Mordecai's good side, right? He's now the second in command. But it seems more consistent with the writer's use of previous elements in the story that this fear is related to the fulfillment of words uttered by Zeresh. What did she say about Haman? The second time. If you've started to fall before Mordecai, what? Paraphrase if you like. You're doomed, right? He's of Jewish descent. You're done for. Sorry, no helping that. That was the attitude taken by even his wife. She recognized. So what is it that these people are actually recognizing? Is it that the Jews are scary? The God of the Jews is scary. Yeah. There's a fear of God. Even though God isn't mentioned explicitly in this text, That's what we're talking about. It's that same fear that Rahab talked about. We've seen the things that your God has done. What did Nebuchadnezzar say when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are standing in the furnace? How did he refer to them? He said, "Come out." And what did he say? "You servants of the Most High God." He knew. In that moment, he understood. And there was an audience. That wasn't done in a closed environment. It's in public. They were supposed to be executed in front of a bunch of other people. And then the king has to walk that back a little bit and says, "Come out of there, you servants of the Most High God. Now I know that there is no other God, that your God can save." So again, the deeds of the God of the Jews were well known. They were public. The Persians and the Babylonians and the other inhabitants of this area, they'd heard of him. They understood what was at stake here. So again, we see God's involvement in the story by noting that parallel here. And now, at last, the Jews have gained mastery over their enemies. So, in most years, the Hebrew calendar has 12 months. But because it's a lunar calendar, the 12th month is known as Adar. And there are 29 or 30 days in each month. About one out of every 3 years, they add an extra month. That's how they keep their calendar on cycle with the solar year. The extra month was called Adar 2. By custom, Purim is always celebrated in the second Adar during such years, not in the first Adar. Evidently, in the year of Haman's decree, there was only a single month of Adar. All right, so the Jews defend themselves. Who has Esther chapter 9, verses 1 through 10? All right, somebody get Matt up here.
On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. This day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities and all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them because the people of all other nationalities were afraid of them. And all of the nobles of all the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because of fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. The Jews struck down all of their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Parashandatha, Dolphin, Espatha, Paratha, Adalia, Aridatha, Parmashta, Ardisai, Aridai, and Hamandatha, or in Vazatha, the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hamandatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder.
All right, so massive props for getting through those 10 names. Very well done. I picked the right guy for that, apparently. So there's the 10 sons of Haman named. So 9 months later, on the 13th of Adar, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to gain mastery over them, but instead, the Jews assembled in their cities and were helped by the government officials and those doing the king's business. It says the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. So, note some important details. The victims were the enemies, those who hated them. They notably did not kill the women and children, and they didn't plunder them. That's mentioned a couple of times. It says that they did what they pleased to those who hated them. Now, I want to walk that through a little bit. That doesn't imply some kind of killing frenzy that they were in. It implies that they were not restrained by the officials. They were allowed to do as they pleased. All right. neat little slide of Assyrian soldiers in battle with an enemy from Nimrod in the 9th century BC. Esther requested and was granted the right for the Jews in Susa to add another day for battling their enemies. We're not given a specific reason, but the notation says that an additional 300 were killed on the second day. So there were still enemies of Jews in the capital, apparently. The relief here comes from the palace of Ashurbanipal II at Nimrod. It's in the British Museum. All right. The king hears the news. Let's read Esther chapter 9, verses 11 through 16. We've got Matt over here with that.
That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what furthers your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder.
All right, so we've got a total of 800 people killed in the capital alone. And then at Esther's request, we have the time that was extended. Out in the provinces, the death toll rises to 75,000. And you may be wondering, well, how does that compare to the population at the time? The largest empire in history was the Achaemenid Empire, better known as the Persian Empire. It accounted for approximately 49.4 million people out of an estimated 112.4 million people globally in around 480 BC. So, if you do the math, that's 44% of the world that the Persian Empire covered in terms of population. That's astounding. That's almost half the world, essentially, that was under Persian control. The empire was first established by Cyrus the Great. It included parts of Central Asia, the Mediterranean, North Africa, and even European territories like ancient Thrace and Macedonia. You can actually find that in the Guinness Book of World Records. So there you go. They were the largest empire pretty much ever in ancient times. In Susa, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Susa was one of several royal cities built by the Persians. It's the setting for all the major events of the Book of Esther. I have to put my glasses on to read this name. Demiroshedji suggests that the language of the Book of Esther reflects the different areas of the city. The distinction between the two parts of the city can be noticed in the Book of Esther. You have Susa the citadel, the royal city, and then Susa, without qualification, which applies to the unfortified lower city. There's virtually no excavation that's taken place on the unfortified lower city, so we're not entirely sure how big it is. So it's estimated that the rest of it was here. Here's the royal city, the palace, the Acropolis, and we've already seen the size of that palace, right? It's huge. So just to give you kind of an idea of the scale of this thing, that's meters. I don't do metric. But large city, well populated. So 800 people that were killed in the citadel of Susa. And we're going to finish up chapter 8 with the Feast of Purim. All right, who's got chapter 9, verses 17 through 32? Jacob.
This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th day and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned from them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and to cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the term Pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them, that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority, confirming the second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their feasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing.
So on the slide overhead, we have these children in Purim costumes in Jewish communities today. They wear costumes and masks, as these children are doing. They weren't kidding about obligating themselves and their descendants to do it. They meant it. And they still celebrate Purim to this day. There is also the practice of giving gifts to the poor. In Jewish communities, you can find a lot of these kinds of donation areas where they will go in and they'll, at Purim, they'll put together these things for their less well-off members to come and have. I always thought it was interesting that you've got this die, the pur, the lot, that Haman had cast to crush and destroy them. Haman sought the time for the destruction of the Jews by casting the lot and relying on the gods to give direction to his timing. As it turned out, there was a god who gave direction to his timing. It just wasn't the one that he wanted. The God of Israel directed the lot in order to frustrate Haman's plot. The Persian practice of casting lots is mentioned by Herodotus and Xenophon. The example of this lot here comes from Mesopotamia. I'm running out of time, but I want to show you the scrolls of the Book of Esther here. And these were photographed at the Jewish Museum of Rome. All right, we have Mordecai's legacy. Let's go ahead and read Esther chapter 10. It's only 3 verses. And then we'll follow up with just a minute of
Esther chapter 10. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. And all the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people.
All right. So the last slide that I want to show you is 4 tombs visible here from left to right. Darius II, Artaxerxes, Darius the First, and then Xerxes. That's all the acts of power and their might that's recorded. There are the tombs of the kings of Persia. So, in the last 5 minutes, what did you take from the book of Esther? When you're reading the book, what do you look at? Okay, the providence of God. I like to think about that in terms of even when God's not speaking directly to us, that his hand can be seen in our lives, and sometimes in very active ways, if we think about it. We mentioned a few weeks back the improbability of certain events in our lives that leads us to conclude that God's hand has been active. Go ahead, Jim.
I'm just
going to
wait until you're finished, but
I'm done.
It speaks to how God chooses to make things right in his own time. Here we see clearly that he did make things right in, you know, this planet, you know, the earth's time. But it gives us confidence that he will make things right as he's promised for eternity one day. We don't always see him make things right, you know, from our point of view in this life. But I think he gives us examples like this one where he does make things right so that we understand he has the ability, working through his providence, and that he will deliver on his ultimate promise to make all things right at some point.
I think that's a great thought. We've got promises from God. We have promises that Jesus gave us. And God delivers on those promises. He delivered on his promise to protect the Jews. He takes care of his people. In a collective sense, not just in an individual sense, but collectively the Jews were saved. And that's some of the Jews that may have been great people and some of the Jews that may have been less great people, but God takes care of his people. Go ahead.
I was also going to add that we see here, like we did with King Cyrus, that God can work through people that aren't his people. And it also made me think of the verse in Genesis that God will bless those who bless Israel and curse those who curse Israel.
I have that point written down, actually, that God's work is done through imperfect agents. We have, for all his flaws, Xerxes as an instrument of God's will. He is working for God whether he knows it or not. And again, we've seen some of Xerxes' flaws, but he's also, ultimately, he has done what God wants him to do. Go ahead, Brother Dad.
Just a reminder comment that God's not mentioned in this writing. If we had this writing in some other context, it'd be a whole different and unusual conversation. But the context of the rest of Scripture lets us fill in a lot of things behind the scenes in the story of Esther.
It does, but do you feel like if we took this book entirely out of context, it would read really weird, wouldn't it? We think, what a bizarre set of circumstances. It'd be a story that would be fantastical. And instead of fantastical, we read it as providential because of that context. Got a minute left. Anyone else? All right, so I have two more takeaways. God wants us to be willing to act on his behalf, even when that could negatively impact us. The concept of suffering for doing the right thing isn't new, and God rewards those who go through such trials. Look at Matthew chapter 5, verses 11 and 12, where he says, "You are blessed when they insult and persecute you and falsely say every kind of evil against you because of me. Be glad and rejoice, because your reward is great in heaven, for that's how they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So people like Esther, people like Mordecai, who endure that persecution and yet do what's right anyway, are the kinds of people that God wants to work on his behalf. On the flip side of that, it's up to us to recognize opportunities to do what is good and to take those opportunities when we see them. All right, I'm just about out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and say anything else before we close. If not, I very much appreciate everyone's attention and your comments, and I won't see you next week. Thank you very much.